WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC, and Robert Guest, business editor of The Economist, is with us now. He can give us his take on Europe's economy on the brink, and he has a new book called Borderless Economics, Chinese Sea Turtles, Indian Fridges, and the New Fruits of Global Capitalism. I don't know if fruits is the word that we would use to describe Europe's borderless economics right now, but here we are, and here is Robert Guest, business editor of The Economist. There's also Occupy London news this morning that maybe we'll get to with him, as well as Occupy Wall Street. Hi, Robert. Welcome to WNYC.
I'm very happy to be here.
First off, the Chinese sea turtles in your subtitle, those are actually people, right?
Those are actually people. That's a Chinese pun that doesn't really work in English. But it refers to the Chinese people who study or work overseas and then go back to China. And there are a huge number of them. It's like sort of 500,000, mostly gone back in the past decade. And that number's accelerating all the time because the Chinese elite, the ultimate thing they all want is to send their kids to American universities. So this means that, you know, when they come back, first of all, they completely dominate the technology sector there and the think tanks that advise the government, but they're also rising up within the Communist Party. And you can see that the proportion of foreign educated people getting larger and larger within the Communist Party. And so you've got this strange thing that a really large proportion of the leadership of this authoritarian company, country have firsthand experience of how an advanced democracy works. They know that, you know, the air is cleaner, it's much richer, that, you know, people have this mechanism for solving political disputes without killing each other. And that knowledge is there. And I'm basically saying that's how China's going to go democratic.
I want to play a clip of Mitt Romney from the Republican debate the other day, making China seem like a big enemy of the United States rather than a trading partner. Listen.
China is playing by different rules. One, they're stealing our intellectual property. Number two, they're hacking into our computer systems, both government and corporate. And finally, they're manipulating their currency, and by doing so, holding down the price of Chinese goods. If I'm president of the United States, I'm making it very clear. I love free trade. I want to open markets to free trade, but I will crack down on cheaters like China.
Now, to contrast that with that, listen to the response from candidate John Huntsman, who, as you know, is a Republican presidential hopeful, but he was President Obama's China ambassador.
I mean, you can give applause lines and you can kind of pander here and there. You start a trade war if you start slapping tariffs randomly on Chinese products based upon currency manipulation. That's not a good idea.
So that was from the CNBC Business Issues debate last week. Which of those attitudes would you rather see in the White House? And is this debate relevant to the theme of your book?
Well, I'd much rather see John Huntsman's attitude in the White House. I mean, yeah, look, the Chinese government does do some things and there is intellectual property theft. But when you're talking about currency manipulation, what you're saying is Americans are living beyond their means and Chinese government is suppressing the consumption of its own people in order to lend money to Americans to fund their credit card habit. Now, that's probably something that's got to change in the long term, but it's not going to change because you tell them to get stuffed and it's not actually harming you.
Is that a form, though, of borderless economics, to quote your book title, which wouldn't have happened in the past when it wasn't so easy to have, you know, instant global exchanges of money through technology or whatever?
The big change that's happened is the Chinese economy has gotten much bigger. And the borderlessness of my book is about, it's about the movement of people. I mean, you can write about the movement of goods, you can write about the movement of other things, but I'm writing about the movement of people and how they bring ideas with them. And, you know, the fact that you have lots of immigrants in America is tremendously helpful for your relations with China, because it means it's much easier to do business with China if you've got Chinese Americans working for you. And it's much easier to have good relations with China. I mean, like the American ambassador to China, Gary Locke, okay? He's Chinese American. And he is a superstar in China because, you know, they see this guy, he's Chinese, he stood for election before, he's humble, he stands in queues rather than barging to the front. And the Chinese people admire him so much that the Chinese government have put a semi-blackout on news reports of him.
I don't see New York listed in your index, but I would think New York City, in this view of the world, would stand to do remarkably well given our global immigration patterns to this city.
That's absolutely right. My basic argument is that when people are allowed to move freely around the world, this is good for people. You know, they bring ideas to the countries they move to. They bring ideas back to the places they came from when they move back. And they keep much more in contact than they used to. It used to be that immigrants would just bring dynamism and energy to countries. They still do that, and that's still very important. But, you know, in the old days, immigrants would come and they'd almost immediately lose contact with the places that they came from because it was so, you know, a telephone call would cost your entire life savings, you know, plane flights didn't exist.
Not to mention going back and forth, right?
Exactly. Nowadays, it's really cheap to keep in touch. You can call many times a day. You can send money back in seconds. You can fly back often. And so you've got all these border-straddling people, families, micro-multinationals. You know, it used to be to set up a multinational business. You had to be big. Now it can be two people, you know, one Chinese guy in Maryland and his cousin in Guangdong or something, and they can operate a business. And this is tremendously good for the world.
Now, there's a certain on the surface to saying if capital can flow freely across the borders, which it already can, labor should be allowed to also. Are you getting at that kind of literally open borders for people vision of the world with a book titled Borderless Economics?
Yes, I am. Look, I mean, in the short term, no rich country is going to completely open its borders to unskilled immigration from other countries. I'm saying they should allow a lot more of it. I'm saying that this is way more effective than foreign aid. I mean, just fantastically more effective.
But when you look at which interest groups are actually for this, you can see who the winners and losers probably are. The odd bedfellows of the Wall Street Journal editorial page and advocates for immigrants' rights are for it. American labor unions are against it in the context of this country. So employers win because wages get pushed down. Current American workers lose for that reason. And immigrants from developing countries win because they get to move from third world poverty to American working poor status, I guess, which is better. I realize that's an overgeneralization. Yeah, but that's what interest group positions are telling us.
Okay. Well, I don't agree with your analysis there. When a worker moves from a poor country to a rich one, his wages become almost exactly like those of the people of the same skill level in the country that he's moved to, and almost nothing like the wages of the country that he's moved from. And the evidence suggests that if there is any depressing effect on American wages, it's somewhere around zero. I mean, it's almost nothing. They're doing complementary things. And when you have, you'll see that sort of, I don't know, crane operators might be sort of 99% American. But
then why are unions so against it?
Because they misunderstand what's going on. They really don't get it. When immigrants come in, they create jobs. This is not just with the skilled ones. Obviously, if you have an engineer who comes in from far away, he'll make an American company more efficient, more productive, all that kind of thing. But it's also about the unskilled laborers. You have all these women, okay, here who can go out to work because they have cheap childcare from Mexico. That makes a huge difference to America. And you compare it with a country like Japan where they don't allow any unskilled immigration at all. And women can't go out to work.
Europe with the Eurozone is borderless economics. How's that working out these days?
Well, there's three things that's gone on in Europe. There's the free movement of labor part, okay? That has been a huge success. There's been the free trade within the Euro area. That has been a huge success. And then there's been the common currency, which has been a monumental disaster, and that's what we're dealing with at the moment. So, you know, interestingly, I mean, it does get to the theme of my book here, because at root what's going on in Europe, the debt crisis, it's a demographic crisis. It's because Europeans have stopped having babies, And so there aren't the young people to pay for the pensions for the old people. Now, you could solve that with immigration, but Europe is not nearly as good as America is at assimilating immigrants because we pay them not to work. You can subsist on welfare. And that kind of screws up the benefits of immigration. Here, they have to work.
As business editor of The Economist, can I get a quick take from you on what you think is going to happen in Europe? The worst-case scenarios, which another guest said yesterday, are not that far-fetched, would be that the banks could start to fail around the continent as they start to take big losses on Greek, then Italian, then maybe even French debt. Then it's much worse than 2008, even a global financial crisis born of that third category of borderless economics. Do you think that's a real possibility?
It's a real possibility. I mean, look, we can handle Greece going down because it's not very big. We cannot cope with Italy going down. And so my best guess is that the European Central Bank and the Germans and the solvent people will stop the panic, bail it out, and prevent it from going down. But if it does go down, then yes, it's worse than 2008.
Is there a borderless economics view of the Occupy movement? In from London this morning, civic authorities say they are resuming legal action to evict a protest camp outside St. Paul's Cathedral after talks with the protesters stalled. We hear what's going on in New York and Lower Manhattan today as well. But in terms of the underlying economics, the 1%, the 99%, distribution of wealth, lack of accountability, is there a borderless economics view of all of this?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'm completely in favor of people's right to stand up and say whatever they like whenever they like it. And secondly, you know, the Occupy guys, it's not a very coherent message, but they do have some good points. There's been a lot of cronyism, which I would completely oppose. There's been a lot of handouts by the government to favored corporations, and that's something we should stop. I'd be in favor of, you know, people standing and failing on their own merits.
Robert Guest, his new book is Borderless Economics. He's business editor of The Economist. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Another take on all of that coming up on the Leonard Lopate Show today, economist Jeffrey Sachs from the Earth Institute at Columbia University. And coming up next right here on the Brian Lehrer Show, artist Shepard Fairey, who, among other things, has a You Are Invited to the Occupation Party piece that we'll ask him about. And Christy McClear, executive director of the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation. They are making Shepard Fairey their first official artist as activist. Stay with us.